Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Boker Tov, Anthony, how are you?
Boker Tov, it's interesting to hear traffic report because we don't have such a thing at the moment.
Wow. Yeah, you've got
like
no traffic.
Everything is flowing, you know, no traffic.
Yeah. You know, we'll try and organize a traffic report for you tomorrow, one for Israel. We have done that in the past where we used Google Translate and then translated back. It's always interesting how those come out.
There won't be much to report, I can already tell you.
Yeah.
Traffic. Really, I mean, you know, people are just literally in a lockdown situation. Schools are not operating, so the roads are really, really quiet at the moment.
All right. Anthony, let's get into some of the news stories. Israel's coronavirus death toll yesterday exceeded 2,000 for a country with a population of 8.6 million people. That's a very, very high death toll. Is that in total?
That is in total 2,000 people over the entire period of the coronavirus, both waves. I mean, because we're literally already on the downside of the second wave. Let's just put it into perspective, because we do have statistics about deaths per population and things like that. So Israel's deaths per 1 million of population comes up to 220 people, which is above the world average. The world average is sitting at 139 at the moment. Interestingly, just to put things into perspective, and that puts Israel, by the way, at 39, number 39 on the list of countries in terms of deaths per 1 million population. Put it into perspective, South Africa is number 28 on the same list, 300 deaths per 1 million of population. Interestingly, the top, countries on the list, besides the very small ones, Peru actually is a country with a substantial population, 33 million people. They are really the country with the highest number of deaths per population if you disregard San Marino, because I think their small population really just skews things. 1,000 deaths in Peru per 1 million of population, followed by Belgium, Andorra, Bolivia, Brazil, Spain, Chile, Ecuador, and the USA. Those are the top 10 countries on the list. So it's not a proud moment for Israel in terms of the number of people who have died from the coronavirus. And interestingly, out of those 2,000 who have passed away, 1,000 of them are just in the last month. So this second wave has been deadly for Israel, really deadly. We're just now trying to cope with the after effects, not the after effects, but we're literally in the middle of trying to bring the numbers down on the second wave. It seems as if, though, from what we've gathered, that the lockdown over the past few weeks has had an effect. If we believe the numbers that we're reading now, there are fewer infections than there were before. There is talk about kindergartens and primary schools potentially being opened for face-to-face learning already as early as next week. Apparently, at the moment, we are told that there are about 827 people in serious condition, 227 people connected to ventilators. We learned and we spoke yesterday about the fact that there is a sort of a private system within a system which is not included as part of these numbers in terms of the ultra-Orthodox community, people who are being treated at home. So they're not part of these numbers. So I'm suspecting that when we talk about serious cases, we're probably talking about closer to 1,000 people right now. But there are some wonderful success stories of cities, towns that were seriously infected with corona and that have somehow managed to gain control over it. One or two ultra-Orthodox towns where the infection rates were very high, and the rabbinical authorities, together with the local municipality, together with the citizens of that, the residents of that particular town, really locked down and managed to gain control over things. Also, some very good success stories coming out of the Arab population, some Arab towns and villages which were very seriously infected and affected and have somehow managed to gain control over things. And one hopes that those can serve as something of an example for the other towns and cities, especially places like Jerusalem and Bnei Brak, where the numbers continue to be very high, much higher than the general population in Israel. But really the 2000 mark, I think, is a significant number, and it's certainly not over yet. We are far from over, and this wave that we're suffering is unlikely to be the last one. I think we will see a downturn. We're seeing a downturn, and I think that will continue at least for the foreseeable future. But inevitably, as we begin to open up again, there's going to be more infection. And so the real question that we don't seem to have answers to at the moment, or I think you mentioned that New Zealand might have an answer to it, but the question that we can't seem to grapple with is, how do we open our economy and somehow also keep control over the extent to which the virus is infecting people and spreading around? That is really the magical question that we're seeking answers to, because we desperately need to open the economy. That goes without saying.
Incredible. Anthony, is there any update on how Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky is doing?
So from what I've gathered, there hasn't been an official update from Rav Kanievsky's family. There have been some conflicting stories about how well he's doing. He has surprised me in that at 92 years old, he still seems to be functioning in some sort of way. He's being treated at home, from what I can gather. There was some disturbing footage of showing him over Sukkot actually passing out in front of the cameras while being presented at a group. It seems as if, though, despite the fact that he's been infected with the virus, he hasn't seemed to they don't seem to have isolated him away from other people, which is a bit of a surprise to me. But he seems still to be functioning in the way more or less that he was functioning before. He is elderly. There's no way that we would expect him to be fully functional, even if he wasn't suffering from corona. We know that he was obviously suffering from some of the effects of old age. We don't have any official update, however, about his situation at the moment.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Yesterday, the Israeli government survived a vote of no confidence.
Yeah, not only a vote of no confidence, which I don't think we were surprised that they would survive. I mean, ultimately, the decision was voted down in the Knesset by 53 votes to 30, which means that if we put the numbers together, that's 83 people who voted. So there were somehow 37 votes missing from somewhere. I'm not quite sure where those 37 votes were. Some of the members of Knesset we know are suffering from corona or in isolation. But still, there seems to be quite a lot of people who did not attend that vote or did not vote one way or the other. But I think the main issue coming out of the vote from yesterday's Knesset session, which was, by the way, the first Knesset session of the winter season, the winter Knesset meeting period. Yesterday was the first time that the Knesset got together, albeit socially distanced and all that. But the main discussion point coming out of yesterday's vote of no confidence was Naftali Bennett. He has been in the news quite a lot recently because his popularity has soared in the opinion polls. And my personal view is that he's only very popular because he hasn't done very much and therefore hasn't done anything wrong. When you don't do very much, I guess you can't do much wrong.
Yes.
I don't think he's done a great deal right. And the problem is that everybody else seems to have put things wrong, made missteps along the way. And so therefore people are seeking an alternative in order to support who's not in that same situation. And certainly Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost a lot of support, as has Deputy Prime Minister Benny Gantz, because of the fact that people feel that he's just been pushed around a little bit too much and not necessarily stood up to Prime Minister Netanyahu very strongly. But yesterday, in the vote of no confidence, it was Naftali Bennett who actually came out supporting the vote of no confidence. Now, when we see the way that the Knesset is put together, we have, of course, the coalition government, which is considered to be a right-wing coalition government involving the Likud and some of the other right-wing parties and, of course, the ultra-Orthodox parties. Naftali Bennett, who's considered to be part of the right-wing bloc, is not in the government. He is outside of the government. So he's effectively supporting the opposition, which is being labeled as a left-wing opposition led by Yair Lapid. Yair Lapid was the person, of course, who proposed the vote of no confidence. If it had passed, he would effectively have become prime minister right away. Naftali Bennett supported the vote of no confidence, thereby supporting Yair Lapid effectively as a prime ministerial candidate, potential a replacement as prime minister. Of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu was very, very quick to call Naftali Bennett a conniver. What a word, a conniver. Supporting the left-wing bloc, even though he is considered to be a member of the right wing. Apparently the Likud have been instructed, all members of the Likud have been instructed to go on the attack against Naftali Bennett. And I think that this is really all arising from the fact that he's become so popular in the opinion polls, and the Likud have decided that they really need to go on the offensive against his public popularity in order to somehow knock him down and gain a little bit of support back for the Likud. One of the interesting comments, my last statement on this particular matter, an interesting comment that was made yesterday was the fact that even in the worst of the opinion polls, the Likud still comes out with the most seats. That was a quote from one of the Likud members yesterday. Not a very, very positive one, but maybe it's also a statement about where we are as a country and as a society.
Very interesting. Anthony Reich, I think that unless we can do it in 1 minute,
yes.
The first maritime shipment of goods from the UAE landed at Haifa Port yesterday. I have to know, what were they shipping?
Well, a whole lot of things, to be honest. And I think, you know, obviously the fact that these goods have arrived at Haifa Port has been a very, very big deal indeed. Let's not kid ourselves. This is really not the first shipment of goods to Israel from the UAE at all. This is just the first direct shipment where the bill of lading said Abu Dhabi to Haifa. Open, honest, everybody's disclosed everything. Of course, there's been a lot of trade going on beforehand behind the scenes, but this was the first official open trade. Apparently, the ship carried iron, firefighting equipment, cleaning equipment, and some electronic equipment. That's what the official documents say. I don't know why iron is coming from Abu Dhabi, but there you are, to Israel. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is a big moment. I think it also shows that when you go and sign peace accords, then it brings economic activity. And I think that that's mostly what this is all about. And this is most of the advantage that we hope to see coming out of, you know, besides the friendship and, you know, the support in the diplomatic sphere, in the political arena. All of that is important. But ultimately, I think this is all about economic cooperation. And we certainly look forward to more cooperation. Apparently, there are going to be weekly shipments now on the route between Abu Dhabi and Haifa, and also coming from Jabal Ali Port in the United Arab Emirates. So if we're talking about weekly shipments, it means there is good economic cooperation already arising so soon after the peace agreement has been signed.
What extraordinary times we live in. Anthony Reich, that is where we leave it. Thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you tomorrow. Have a good day.
Look forward to it.